Deezer Originals.
This is Defending in Numbers.
Hello, 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 and welcome to Defending in Numbers, the football podcast where we walk down the corridor of uncertainty pretending to know a little bit more about the beautiful game than we really do. My name is Rob Armstrong, and I am here, one-legged, one-brain-celled, knowing nothing about the great game of football, but here to help me is the most electrifying man in all of football statistics, George Ellick. How are you, George?
Hi, mate. Yeah, very good. Good to be back.
Good. And joining you, a debutant today, we have David Priest. David, how are you?
I'm very well, mate. I like the electrifying.
Yeah. And I get it every time.
We need to think of something for you.
Well, I think the good thing, I mean, even with you on one leg, I think having Priest here means it would be quite a good three-a-side team, which would be good because, you know, we've got an ex-pro here.
Yeah, he's, I mean,
he'd have to play left wing though, wouldn't he?
Well, no, he'd be on the bench for me and you. You and Net, and then me just running around like a madman.
I was going to say, we might have to put David outfield. I'll have to take the goalkeeper in place. We'll see what you've got outfield. I'm not moving anywhere anytime soon. So everyone, look forward to some painkiller influenced podcasting coming up. Of course, you can find us on Deezer, on iTunes, and all the places where you find podcasts and listen to podcasts and do all of those kind of things. Share, rate, review, and subscribe. And now, without further ado, let's get on to Week by Numbers.
The Week by Numbers.
So let's start with the most exciting moment of Italian football I've seen in at least 3 days. Or 4 days by the time it's come out. I was sitting there on Sunday, waiting for my lovely knee surgery on Monday morning, thinking, what am I going to do to relax myself? So I decided to watch Benevento, AC Milan, assuming that it would be a kind of routine win for AC Milan. But then in the 95th minute, that's 95, the number, in case anyone was wondering, up pops Alberto Brignoli to score and equalise for Benevento, earning them their first ever point in Serie A. David, I've got to come to you as a goalkeeper. How much did you enjoy seeing that?
It's the dream, isn't it?
Particularly in the circumstances.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's only one thing I've got about goals by goalkeepers in this sort of manner is that I don't tend to count them as goalkeeper goals.
Wow.
A real goalkeeper goal for me, in my book, is scored from your own box. A la Paul Robinson, yeah. Tim Howard. Yeah. That's Mia Begovic. That's a proper goal. When you can score from 90 yards away.
So we're discounting goal. Jimmy Glass. He's a nobody.
Isn't the theory there that that's luck, though? And this is, you know, this is actual skill. Have any of those guys actually meant it?
Is wind not the scorer there?
That's the assist, yeah.
Tell Schillebe and Campos you're taking their goals away from them and see how they like that.
No, but it was remarkable. And you look at the technique in it as well. It's like he's been shot out of a cannon. It reminds me of Mark Poombs for Sunderland against Derby about 15 years ago, hands by the sides, head forwards, and it just sort of slaps him on the back of the head. Yeah. It's ridiculous that it goes anywhere near the goal, really.
The thing that I think is great about it is that it was fairly evident before a ball was kicked this season that Benevento are going to have to enjoy their one season in Serie A, and so far they haven't enjoyed it whatsoever, and pointless going into December. But seeing the reaction of the fans to that equaliser, doing it against AC Milan, doing it at your home stadium, I don't reckon there's a single fan who would take that moment for points earlier in the season.
Yeah,
I think being pointless and having that moment where you get your first point with your keeper scoring 95th minute equaliser against the giant of Italian football that is, you know, AC Milan, even though in their current state they're not at the top, is absolutely unbelievable. The flip side of it is that I think the storyline behind it is good news for a certain Gattuso, because that is Gennaro Gattuso's first game in charge of Milan. He has had a very rocky start as manager in his career so far. At Pisa, he had some success. He was very, very bad, or very, very poor at Palermo. He went to managing Crete. I mean, this guy doesn't have the credentials whatsoever to be a Serie A manager, despite his fantastic playing career. He even tried to return to Scotland, obviously, where he was, where he played for Rangers as manager for Hamilton Academical, replacing Alex Neil about 4 years ago, and didn't get that job. So I think that whilst the story for Benevento is a good one and their fans are rightly excited, I think the warning bells are already starting to ring for the club legend that is Gattuso and his time in the dugout at AC.
Yeah, it's been a bit of a horror show so far this year for AC Milan, given that all that money that came in at the beginning of the season, we all thought they were going to I mean, I don't know about you, but I thought they were going to walk the Europa League, be back in the Champions League next year, probably do really well in the league as well. But it's Inter Milan, actually, that are doing the better of the two.
I think there are massive parallels between Inter and AC and Milan in terms of, it was exactly the same for Inter last season. They had a huge investment at the beginning of the season. They brought in lots of players and they were atrocious, to be honest. They were really, really poor. And now, going into this weekend, where they're playing Juve on Saturday, they're top of Serie A. So this stuff takes time.
Yeah, and it probably negates the argument that everyone's got with Pep Guardiola. Now, he has had a hell of a lot more money to spend even than those two Italian clubs have spent. But it's how you spend it. If you don't spend it right, it's easy just to fritter it away. And Everton as well, maybe he's not on the same level, but you can spend as much money as you like, but if you're not spending on the right players, then it doesn't matter how much money you've got.
Yeah, what they need is to get an on-loan goalkeeper from Juve, stick him up front,
yeah,
and just fire the ball at his head. Agent Brignoli. All right, let's move on to the next number, and that's number 19, and that's the number of red cards Sergio Ramos has received in La Liga, the most in the competition's history. So it's not been the greatest year for Real Madrid so far, I think it's fair to say. And this is a record I would say they don't want. Obviously, last year that we saw them break in records as in, you know, first team to defend the Champions League, Ronaldo making goal-scoring records every week. Is this sort of symptomatic maybe of Real Madrid's season so far? They've got another red card and another sort of bump in the road. Barcelona drew and they didn't capitalise on it.
Possibly. I think that Ramos has always been this kind of player. He's always had problems with his discipline, and it's easy to pick holes in the fact that he's been sent off this weekend and align it with Real Madrid, when actually during Real Madrid's periods of dominance and success, he also was a hothead and used to get sent off a lot as well.
19 of them.
Yeah, exactly. So and Ramos, the thing about him is he's a fantastic player. I think his combination of athleticism and ball playing ability makes him fairly unique, and the fact that he gets sent off a fair bit is probably a small price to pay at the end of the day. But with Madrid, it's going to be interesting for them now because they're currently, I think, fourth in the league. They are going to have to probably focus on the Champions League now hugely, because I think that the ship may have sailed slightly for La Liga. It's obviously early days still, and yeah, Barcelona could wobble, but I think we'll see them really focus on getting that third consecutive Champions League. Yeah.
So, David, when a player, speaking from the viewpoint of a professional, when you're someone in your team has a tendency of getting sent off a lot, given that he's meant to have such leadership qualities, you know, he is the captain of Real Madrid, captain of all those egos, he's the one who's the leader of the lot. Is it damaging for the other players to see a player constantly getting sent off?
I think the difference with Real is that they're so dominant in the majority of the games that it doesn't have a real effect on the side. So if it's petulance at the end of a defeat against Barcelona, the game's lost, and then the next few games they're going to win those games easily, so they don't miss him. So it's not like he's costing the team points. I think it does take away from the player that he is, simply because it's not actually part of his game. If you look at someone like Pepe,
yeah.
That was what his game was about. He was about upsetting strikers. He was about being narky. That was all part of his game, and it's how he got to the top. I mean, he was a fantastic. He is still a fantastic defender, but that was all incorporated in the way that he played. Where with Ramos, it's not, and you know, it's difficult to describe him without swearing, really, because it's simply because it's needless most of the time. It's petulant. And from that aspect, then it's, you don't want to see your captain to be like that. You're right, he's got to be an example, but the fact that it doesn't cost him any points and they don't really miss him when he's out, it doesn't make a difference to his teammates, really.
I think a comment on what you were saying about him being the captain and should be leading from the front, I think in a way he probably sees the way he carries himself on the pitch as doing that, and that probably leads to the red cards. He is the person who's going to, you know, the way they play on the front foot so often, they basically play two at the back because, you know, Marcelo's a left back in name, and that's about it. The positions he takes up are way from further advanced in the field. And so I think he probably feels like he has to step up and give that kind of bit of competitive spirit at the back.
Especially now Pepe's gone, his partner in crime.
Yeah, exactly. And so I don't think it's a huge deal. I think he's a fantastic player, and I'm sure he'll be right at the forefront when they do turn it around.
That's mad, isn't it? Like, if it's 19 red cards in LA, how many games has he been suspended for? Because it must be close to 40.
Yeah,
maybe it's nearly a season.
He just loves going back down to Seville and having a bit of time off in the.
Has it worked us right? Every 22 games he gets a red card or something like that.
Really?
Yeah.
Blimey.
Yeah.
Hey, good for him. Lots of holidays.
Yeah, exactly.
Lots of, sitting down in Seville.
Sporting a team in the EFL, it's interesting how many more red cards and bans there seem to be just before Christmas. So he's just missed that boat.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to another Spanish man. And that's with the number 14, David De Gea. And that's the number of saves he made against Arsenal, which was basically the game for me that disproved expected goals. Because Arsenal had a million shots, scored one. But Man United, to be fair, didn't actually look like they were going to lose at any point. I know they conceded one and it went to 2-1, but I still felt confident the whole time that Man United just were going to get there, because it looked like they were sort of soaking up the Arsenal shot, soaking up the Arsenal pressure, and Arsenal were, in a way, kind of crumbling.
I mean,
I think the fact that they gave two soft goals away very early on in the game, it changes the dynamic of
completely.
It so much. And whether it's conscious or subconscious, when you go 2-0 up, then you do take your foot off the pedal a little bit and you do relax, and you maybe concede a little bit more possession than you would do. You're right, the amount of shots they perhaps should have been, you know, at least get themselves back in the game. But then you look at the quality of the game, and 14 saves, they weren't all crucial saves.
Yeah.
There was, I'd say, max five.
And I think some of them were bad finishing as well.
That save from Sanchez was absolutely unbelievable. Basically, a sliding tackle, having just made a save. That was the one that really stood out.
Yeah.
But it's I suppose a save that a lot of goalkeepers might not, simply because he's using his feet. It's a massive part of his game. And even though maybe to a lot of people might seem like it's just a natural instinctive reaction, it's not. Some keepers, when you're trained to react to second shots, to second balls once you've saved the first one, it's to get back on your feet and maybe go to a game with your hands and get your body forward so you can sort of block it, where he was just instinctive. Because he used his feet so much, that's probably more in the front of his mind than most keepers. And now he's actually changing the way that goalkeepers train, you know, with the K-shape that he pulls when he's blocking shots 1v1. It's not like, and a lot of people kind of lazily say that Manuel Neuer's revolutionised goalkeeping. He hasn't revolutionised.
You were doing it years ago, Preece, weren't you?
Yeah. Well, that was just a bad judgement. I used to switch off and just forget where I was. But in the he's just took it to another level because he does everything so much better than a lot of keepers you compare him to, but he's in a different way. The way that De Gea is playing the game, and the way that the techniques he's using, you can see now it's very influential in how the art's being coached.
It's funny as well, isn't it? Because the other keeper that equals the record with Tim Krul, obviously playing for Newcastle, a very different quality of team, standard of team. You don't often see the absolute best, the best goalkeepers having to work this hard normally. I think, you know, you look at teams that often come in for sort of England contention, and it's ones that, you know, like someone like Tom Heaton or Jack Butland or Joe Hart, who are getting peppered with shots all season. Jordan Pickford as well, just facing shots all the time. And I think you forget sometimes the hardest thing for a lot of the goalkeepers is that concentration thing. So it was entertaining to see a keeper who you're used to seeing have to save two shots a game, have to be in constant work.
I completely agree, and it was a, you know, amazing performance from him. I was surprised watching the game to hear Steve McManaman at halftime say that he thought that Mourinho's advice to his players would be to keep going more of the same. And they were comfortable, because that wasn't the game I was watching. It felt to me like he just looked at the scoreline and decided that. I don't think they were comfortable at all. I think Arsenal's finishing was poor. I think that United weren't as good at the back as they have been in recent times. On the counter-attack, they were fairly destructive. But on your expected goals point, I feel like my role at the moment seems to be just continually sticking up for the...
I'm the football dinosaur who doesn't understand.
Yeah, no, of course. But I think that, because it's an interesting point, and I do think that, you know, expected goals taken in isolation is always going to be misleading. And I think that in that respect, things like Match of the Day using it isn't particularly helpful, because it's showing people a very small sample size when you need the bigger picture. But having said that, if you look at that in the bigger picture, you mentioned yourself that it was poor finishing. So if, for the likes of Sanchez or whoever it was who are missing easy chances, that will, in a long-term data pool, affect how they're viewed. So that would, the fact that they underperform their XG will therefore go into a huge bigger pile and influence that data stream that will dictate both how Arsenal have performed against their XG and how the players have. And I think that's important still. I think that the fact that De Gea made 14 shots, the fact that they had so many shots from good areas, I think is relevant and necessary to analyse their long-term performance. So whilst I'm not here telling you that I think that you know, the 5-1 scoreline that XG came up with would have been a fair result, I'm not. But at the same time, the story of that game still remains that United were clinical, Arsenal squandered lots of chances, and that's all that's saying. And taken in isolation, it looks misleading, but it is telling, it is giving some value to long-term views on both players and teams.
David, where do you stand on expected goals?
Do you know what? I don't understand what the fuss is all about, really, because it's just a guideline. You know, you're measuring things against an average, and to give you a better insight. You know, it's not something that you're going to use 100%.
No.
You know what I mean? It's something that can help you, you know, if you've watched a game, it can help sort of back up your judgments or the influence of what you're thinking. But you don't have, it's like you have to be either 100%
XG
or you don't, you think it's the most useless stat, quote, useless stat in the in football.
I mean, the two things I would say is that, you know, yourself there, you've said this was the game. I don't, you know, Rob, you're here to be educated on you, so this is fine. So you said it was a game that proved to me there was no useless stat, and then you said Arsenal's finishing was poor. Arsenal's finishing was poor is just a very, very basic way of saying that they underperform their XG. That's all it is. And I'm not saying that as a football fan, XG has much of a role to play in it. When I go and watch Oxford on a Saturday, I couldn't care less what our XG is against, you know, Bradford. Like, who,
traitor.
I'm there because I want 3 points. But both as a, you know, looking for long-term trends, for people who are involved in gambling as well, it's basically proven to be, like, very important and very insightful. So, you know, as the average football fan, I'm not telling you to get involved, but to write off its insight would be foolish.
But it's like all arguments about analytics in football now, that it's a lot of people under the impression that, you know, you'd have to just do it, you do your recruitment or your scouting or your analysing all through numbers, when it's not, you do it's like a mixture between the two.
Exactly.
Okay, so something like XG doesn't take into account sort of, it might be the same position that the player's in unmarked, but there might be spin on the ball. It doesn't take into account the weather, but it doesn't take into account the standard of goalkeeper you're playing against.
Are these your excuses? That there's spin.
But this is if there's a lot of spin, the ball's sort of harder to get direction on a header or a volley. And so in those cases, then you use your own eyes.
Yeah.
It's as simple as that.
And I think with recruitment, Ted Knutson, who runs StatsBomb, always says that recruitment's often, with stats, is often looked at the wrong way, where some clubs or some people will see a player and then delve into their stats, but it should be the other way around. You should use the stats to throw up people whose numbers are interesting, and then you go and watch them. And then you decide with the eye test. You don't just buy them on the back of, oh, you know, he had 15 shots in 2 games from inside a 6-yard box, because, you know, that could be a drop in the ocean. Maybe he hasn't had a shot inside a 6-yard box for 10 years before that. You've got to, you know, just find the diamonds in the rough and then go and find out if they are actually diamonds.
What people have got to understand as well, like XG, it's one of the more accessible stats and parts of analysis, when there is so much more going on deeper than that.
Yeah.
That will be more detailed, that it is a more accurate representation rather than just that. But to be honest, people don't want a TV show where, or the majority of people don't want a TV show where it's just all numbers coming up, because it's not entertaining.
Yeah,
it's a great podcast. It's a great podcast.
No, but we won't be defending numbers, are we?
No, but it is, though. Is it, people talk about, you know, the use of analytics and numbers in sort of for match of the day or something like that. You watch a match of the day for the action. You
know? Yeah.
You go somewhere like we're sitting here now for the numbers. You know, you go to other places for the numbers. It doesn't always have to be sort of everything all in one pot.
I think the fact alone that we're having the conversation is a good thing, because, and I've been accused by certain quite high profile people in football media of being fairly judgy about this, but it's not going anywhere.
I'm right here, George.
it's not going anywhere. So I think, you know, like it or lump it, basically.
All right, let's talk. Talking of expected goals, I personally expected about 40 of them against West Ham the other day, Manchester City. But the number is 155. David Silva has won 155 games as a Manchester City player, the most recent, of course, against West Ham. It's the most in the club's history as a player, and he racked that number up. He put the icing on a cake with his winner against West Ham the other day. People are talking about, there's been a bit of a sort of debate with a few players throughout the week over whether he's the best player Man City have ever had. How good do we think David Silva is? Because in terms of the players they've signed since they got all the money, since it all started with, not even before Robinho, with the Elanos of the world, yeah. Those players that have come in, none of them, well, I suppose this is the debate, have any of them had the influence that David Silva has had?
To influence, I think Vincent Kompany's first 4 or 5 seasons at City were pretty symbolic of a complete shift in, or a power shift in English football. And I think he was the, you know, both iconically and on the pitch was the figurehead of that. But I think that David Silva represents something that is very unique to the Premier League. I think he's such a special player. I think City fans have been saying that he's basically the best player they've ever seen for a long time. And as with all these things in football, you know, people seem to get the credit that they deserve towards the end of their careers, when maybe they're on the wane. I don't think Silva is on the wane. Unlike Giggs winning Sports Personality of the Year when he was about 40. I think he's absolute class. I think he's the closest thing that we've had in the Premier League to Iniesta, where he has that ability to just, his passing ability is absolutely unbelievable. His movement's amazing. He's creative. He's not afraid to get on the ball and keep it simple as well. I'm a huge, huge fan, and I think he deserves all the accolades. I mean, he could score more goals. It's been the case all through his career, but what a finish.
Yeah.
At an important time on the weekend.
But the goals thing, you know, Iniesta doesn't exactly rack him up, does he?
No, but I think...
Is that a pun on Rakitic as well?
No, it's not. But if it makes you happy, it can be.
But I think a big difference might make from now on and going forwards is Kevin De Bruyne. The fact that he often finds himself in deeper positions, going back to pick up the ball and setting things off, it kind of frees David Silva up to be a little bit more forward, and maybe you will see him score more goals and create more goals directly.
Yeah,
because he finds himself further forward.
Yeah, I agree with that, and also because naturally as he gets older, he's not going to be as athletic as he once was, which it makes sense for him to drift into pockets of space. The same has happened with Iniesta. Mm. You know, Iniesta doesn't get on the ball nearly as much now as he used to for Barca. He's almost playing on the left now. Just finding pockets of space which he can then exploit, rather than being on the ball all game. And I think Silva could go that way.
Yeah, and the emphasis probably has been more on him in the past to be that's the hub of creativity.
Yeah.
Whereas now they've got so many options now. They've got 4 or 5 options in one side that can maybe not do the same job as him, but it can create chances and create opportunities.
Well, they've basically got 4 wingers. I mean, yeah. Sané, Sterling, Delph and Walker all just camped, yeah. You know, it's...
In terms of the City's best ever player, I think you got the sort of nostalgic old boy saying Colin Bell.
Yeah.
But then you've got your Agüeros, David Silva.
Your Sean Goaters.
Your Sean Goaters.
Georgie Kinkladze.
Yeah.
Is he? Because think of...
Kinkladze's a nice shout.
It is, yeah.
The trophies they've gone on to win.
But then I think that you romanticise the past so much for these teams.
Yeah.
At the FSF, so I was sitting next to a City fan. And the general consensus is that whilst it's great, you're not as connected to the club as you were when you weren't very good.
Yeah.
And you hear Chelsea fans say it a lot as well. So I think you're going to romanticise the past. But if you're actually levelling them up in terms of footballing talent, I think these guys are going to be pretty far ahead.
I was quite surprised when I went to it must be the first home game of the season against Everton, and just walking to the Etihad and just listening to Man City fans. And there was 3 people I heard say, I think it'll be 1-1 today.
Really?
You know, it's ridiculous. I mean, as a Sunderland fan, imagine myself in their position. I'd be walking there expecting 5-0 every game.
After the news this week, I'd rather imagine them being in their position than being a Sunderland fan.
It must be so strange being a Man City fan and then coming across like young lads that are City fans that have never known. Because I was looking at Man City at the weekend, and I was looking on Twitter a little bit and saw City fans saying, oh, West Ham camped in their box, oh, it's so negative. I'm thinking like 10 years ago, this was you. Like you were as bad, if not worse than us.
Yeah.
And now you're like giving it all this, oh, you can't defend up here, rubbish. And then Fabian Delph said it at the end as well. I was like, oh, well, teams just don't come here. Like, well, yeah, we'd lose 25-0.
I think it's just a different club. I think if they were still at, you know, the fact they moved from Main Road, they moved across town as well. I mean, it's still quite close, but it's still, you know, it's a good few miles away. I think it just doesn't feel like the same club, does it?
I was going to say, you wouldn't find Pep Guardiola playing Edison up front like Stuart Pearce played David James up front. But having said that, so, it might be a bad option, to be honest with you.
He'd be decent.
Yeah, he's probably better than half the strikers in the Premier League.
Yeah.
Did you see the, you must have seen like the comparison video with Joe Hart before he punted it out to Wayne Rooney and then Edison just like controlling it, taking it around someone and passing it off.
Like he's got a cushion on his foot.
Yeah.
He's class.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the Manchester derby then. Given we talked about United, talked about City. Where do we think this is going to go? Because this is a massive, massive, easily the biggest game of the season so far. First v second, I know there's a bit of a gap between them, but every time City have played the last sort of three or four games, there's been that kind of doubt maybe that they'll get the result. It's taken them a little bit later than normal. And now this weekend is kind of the first time we see, okay, is this gap going to go, or are they just going to accelerate and go on for the rest of the season?
City have been level after 82 minutes of the last four games and have gone on to win all four. For me, a lot of people are saying that it's showing a kind of clutch mentality, but for me that shows a drop off in performances, because they were blasting teams away. And obviously it's great that they can get those wins from those difficult positions, but at the same time it's concerning. And I mean that isn't a hard run of games either. West Ham, Feyenoord, Southampton, and one other. And Huddersfield. I think that Jose would have looked at the Arsenal game and been fairly livid with his defenders. And I expect to see a return of the old Manchester United bus this weekend. And they'll try and frustrate City and play on the break, which they, I mean, if Martial is in the kind of mood that he was in, I thought Lukaku was very good against Arsenal as well, despite not scoring. Mm. And they'll try and play fast on the break. And it's going to be interesting. I mean, everything in my head tells me that City should win it, but you know, we know that Mourinho defies logic, and it's going to be a fairly lively affair.
Is it, my theory about it is it knackering playing against 11 men behind the ball every week? Are they sort of struggling to get the big scores again because they're exhausted of trying to break down these defences? Because these last four results, like you say, they're not against the most desirable teams.
Something they beat them as well.
Yeah, but
same type chances.
Yeah, the way they have to play, you know, they look so much better once it gets stretched out a little bit, because they seem to, you know, that Guardiola thing, they can pass between anything they like. But then when it's just these blocks, they've been facing that for, I guess, half a season. When they come up against a better team, is that going to be sort of liberating for them, because they'll get to play sort of properly and it will be maybe less tiring? And then Man United, like you say, the bus is going to come out. So Man United are going to be playing like Huddersfield, but with that extra bit of quality. Is that kind of what we're looking at City? They're almost mental fatigue from trying to break down these teams.
Yeah, but I think they don't panic. They're patient. They don't stray away from what they do in the first minute. So they're doing the same thing in the last 5 minutes. So more than anything, they're not stressing themselves mentally, and that's probably more important than anything they're doing physically. Physically, the forwards have they're moving all the time, but it's not exactly the same as, you know, they're making a lot of runs in behind and tying themselves that way. I think it's been brilliant for me watching them being tested this way, especially against Huddersfield. Huddersfield were magnificent, and it did have a little bit of a feel that it was inevitable what was going to happen. That it was just the breakthrough eventually.
Yeah.
But the fact that they've changed the way that the teams have approached games. It's a long time since I've seen opposition set up so defensively as they have done Man City the last few weeks, and it's, you can say whether it's spoiling or not because it's as a contest, it's not a great. For neutral, it's not a great game to watch, but it is fascinating to see how they cope with it. And it'll probably get other teams. It might get United a draw on Saturday, Huddersfield, like I said, Huddersfield were unlucky. But the only way that a team is going to beat City is by having a go at them. Now, it's a huge risk because, you know, you might end up winning the game. You might lose six. So it's difficult for a manager to do that, and it's a brave manager to do that. But I think that Saturday, somebody's got to give. You know, it's 40 games unbeaten at home, United now.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, and it's 13 straight wins for City. I think someone might give, I think.
They don't look invincible defensively. I think that's fair.
They've conceded in each of the last four games, haven't they?
Yeah. And Mangala.
I mean, say it quietly, but I mean, he gets a lot of stick, so we obviously say it loudly. John Stones is a huge, huge loss for them at the moment. Mm. He started the season so well defensively and on the ball, and having that, you know, Otamendi is doing it at the moment, being that kind of ball playing centre back. But I think we can all agree that Stones is probably better suited to it. And I think they're missing him.
Well, weirdly, it seems to me, because Kompany obviously come back in a couple of games ago, didn't he? He wasn't there on Sunday. I feel like the young players don't look up to Kompany the way they do to Stones, because there's all these new young lads, basically, you know, the 15 attacking midfielders they signed and wingers. Yeah. They seem to sort of look up to...
I don't think Kompany's the same player as he was, sadly. No. And I don't think he ever will be. And it'll be interesting to see how they remedy that, because... He still seems to have that role in the team where when he's fit, he plays, and that may not be the best thing going forward.
Yeah.
But then they don't have many other options either. So I mean, he's probably still a better option than Mangala. So yeah. You know, they need Stones back, I'd say.
Yeah, Mangala is not great.
No,
I think he had to do one thing on Sunday and nearly messed it up, didn't he? Right, let's move on to the final number, and that's 100%, which is Jurgen Klopp's win rate against Everton. Everton have been a real mixed bag this season. We thought they were going to be brilliant at the beginning. I certainly thought they were a shoo-in for seventh place, and then they were horrible. And now they've got Big Sam. Two clean sheets, six goals. But Liverpool also look like they're firing again. That 5-1 win against Brighton the other day, despite having no defenders. They look like they might be sort of getting into... fourth gear, trying to sort of reach their full potential as far as their team goes this season. So what do we reckon for the Merseyside derby? Big Sam versus Klopp.
Depends how much impact Big
was that,
Sam...
Was that breathing out?
Yeah.
The Big Sam or the
just,
Klopp?
No, it depends what Big Sam can do. I'm a Big Sam fan, to be fair. I think this appointment, maybe because the way it was handled, was met with some raised eyebrows, but I think it's a smart appointment. I think that his being labelled as kind of a dinosaur, I think, is unfair. There was a Monday Night Football about 6 weeks ago where he was on with Jamie Carragher and Dave Jones, and they spoke about his managerial philosophy. And it's nothing, you know, mind-boggling, but it's things like when he comes in, he tells his players, just, you know, if you're going to pass the ball backwards, don't do that. That's not the way we're going to play. And while for some managers, you know, possession-based managers, that's going to be the way they want their players to play. He's got a very, you know, good idea of how he wants teams to play, good idea of what wins points, good idea of what creates chances, what stops goals. And if he can implement that quickly at Everton, you know, a lot is said about the way teams play football, but at the end of the day, Everton fans, I can guarantee you, if they're winning games under Big Sam's method of playing, they're not going to care. They might say they will, but they're not going to care. Getting 3 points and playing ugly is better than getting no points and knocking around the back a lot. So, yeah, I personally think this will probably be too early for Sam to have much of an influence. And I think that this Liverpool team are still definitely top four material, at least. So I'd probably see it going their way. But I think it's going to be a fun couple of months to see how Allardyce can... I think this is the job that Allardyce has always wanted, to the extent that he's never going to get a top six job, and Everton's the best of the rest. And I think this is... He'll see it. Having made a bit of a mess of a certain national team job, not the job itself, but of losing it, I think that he'll see this as his opportunity to show the world what he can actually do.
Yeah, Jurgen Klopp, the first Liverpool manager to win his first three Merseyside derbies in the Premier League. David, how good do you think they were at the weekend, and how good do you think they're going to become?
I think we all know that the deficiencies they've got as well. I think that could be telling at the weekend. It's interesting to see that Big Sam isn't going to Cyprus with the side on Thursday night. I think Craig Shakespeare is going to be taking the side. So He's obviously putting a lot of work into this. He knows how important it is for the fans. And in all honesty, Everton have been horrible at the back.
Yeah.
Up until two games ago, they were awful at the back. And if anybody's going to correct that, it's going to be Sam. We talk about defensive deficiencies. They've got Liverpool concede goals from set pieces. That could be one area that he's going to look to try and gain advantage, and they've got the players to do that. They have got some height, good players like Ashley Williams, who are good at attacking the ball, Phil Jagielka, and they've got good delivery as well through Gylfi Sigurdsson. So it could be an area that they're targeting, and that could be one of the things that's Big Sam, why he's not going to Cyprus, because if they've put the work in, put the time into the set pieces, which a lot of clubs don't do. It's still a hugely neglected area of the game. It's connected, or in people's minds, it's connected to direct Neanderthal football. But it's such a huge part. Like, was it a third of all goals scored from set pieces?
Well, look, Real Madrid in the last 3 years have been unbelievably good at set pieces, and they've won two Champions Leagues. I think they've scored. Yeah. We'll come on to that later. But I think they've scored six goals from set pieces this season alone.
Yeah. I think Gylfi Sigurdsson as well, obviously massive money signing for Everton. I think they expected something maybe slightly different from him than what they got. But he, when he saw Big Sam, and obviously Alois, like we say, has a bit of a nuance for set pieces.
Yeah.
I think Gylfi Sigurdsson's stats are going to start flying up, 50, aren't they?
50 million quid for a guy who's good at set free kicks. They should have bought me. I can still whip in a good corner.
Well, yeah, but it's a valuable skill, isn't it?
Think of Payet when we were Sir Alex Ferguson mentioned it about Charlie Adam all those years ago, saying that he was worth the money Liverpool paid for him alone, not because of his corners.
Yeah.
I think that what David said about Williams and Jagielka is important, because I think Williams especially has been culpable for a lot of mistakes, and I think Allardyce needs to work out fairly quickly if those two guys are over the hill, or if he can get them back to their best, because Michael Keane is a very promising centre-back who I'm sure he'll invest in. So he's just got to block that gap and assess whether or not Williams is especially still up to the task.
About Gylfi Sigurdsson, the one thing I couldn't understand is when they paid all that money for him, why not play him in exactly the same position and make an exact as close a link up as you can do that he had with Llorente, instead of, okay, they used him for his set pieces, but they played him out wide. Use him in the role that he was playing for Swansea, to get the best out of him. Play him in the role that's got him the £50 million move in the first place. Now, obviously, it's all like the history behind the Lukaku move and not getting a replacement. But that was as key to making Sigurdsson work, getting somebody that he can link up with and to use as a focal point. Calvert-Lewin's done great for a young kid. He's probably had a lot more of a workload put on him than he thought and that Evan expected to put on him. So perhaps it'll accelerate his development as well. But I just couldn't understand that. You pay £50 million for a player, and then don't use him to his best capabilities.
I think that's a massive question mark about Everton generally, is their strategy. As you mentioned, they bought Sigurdsson and they've got Rooney, who basically want to do exactly the same thing and take up the same positions on the pitch. They got rid of Lukaku, brought in Sandro, like a completely different player. Got Sigurdsson in, as you mentioned, who done so well with Llorente and Bonny before that. Didn't bring in a striker who he could aim for balls in the box. Their ideal manager was Marco Silva. Their second choice was Sam Allardyce. Two completely polar opposite managerial candidates in terms of style, personality, age, background, everything. I'd love to be told who's making the decisions. I think I know who it is, but I'd love to be told how there's any method to what's going on behind
short-sighted,
the scenes.
Short-sighted, isn't it? I think it's such a similar trend with all these teams that spend the big money.
But I think short-sighted can sometimes, when you're in a relegation battle, be fine. But I think it's just not sighted. It's slapdash, and it's basically, pin the tail on the donkey.
Well, you can listen to the Merseyside Derby on Deezer, on the app. You can do whatever you like. You've been walking around. As long as you've got the Deezer app, you'll get a little notification and you can listen in to that on this app. So while you set your reminders for that, let's move on to the next section, I'm Embarrassed to Ask.
I'm Embarrassed to Ask.
All right, so here we are in December, making our Christmas lists, etc., etc. We're all doing it, sending them to our mums, dads, whatever. Managers are also doing it to their chairmans. Terrible grammar. Terrible grammar.
Chairpersons.
Yeah, exactly.
Chairpersons. Bang on. I've been corrected. And so I should be. It's 2017, everyone. But obviously with January, you can start talking to players who have 6 months left on the contract. Am I right? And so I was seeing a list the other day of some of the names with just 6 months left. So these are, you're going to have to explain it to me, lads. You're going to have to educate me on this one. Is this a Bosman transfer if you saw it out 6 months beforehand? Because players with just half a year left on their contract, we've got Alexis Sanchez, Ertzil, Ander Herrera, Juan Mata, Ross Barkley, Emre Can, Daley Blind, Luke Shaw, Fernandinho, Jack Wilshere, Mario Balotelli, Max Meyer, Bernard, Marouane Fellaini, and of course the wonderful in-form West Ham striker, Diafra Sakho. So how can you kind of approach these players in January without it being tapping up? Because that's the phrase that I feel like 10 years ago everyone was using all the time. Everyone's saying, oh yeah, you've tapped him up, whatever. And people were getting sort of in trouble for it. But now you don't really hear it as much. And if there's 6 months left on the contract, it doesn't count. Is that how it works?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was a Belgian player, Mr. Bosman, who about 25 years ago fought a legal case where he wanted to be able to basically move on for free at the end of his contract, which before that wasn't necessarily legal. And I think we take it for granted now. But basically, that is it. On the tapping up subject, I would say that us as football fans romanticise the transfer dealing business quite a lot, and we're also fairly naive. I would say that generally what this will mean, you know, legally a player can't speak to another club without his club's permission unless it's 6 months before and their contract's running out. But, you know, David, you'll know more than me about this, but it's going to be the agents that basically, when you're hearing that, you know, Mesut Ozil's talking to Real Madrid, it's probably not Mesut sitting down with Florentino Perez having a nice chat. You know, it's going to be his agent.
No, he's too busy writing to Duncan Watmore.
It's going
to
be, yeah, it's going to be his agent having a chat with representatives of who are linked to Madrid to sound out whether or not there's a possible, you know, that's how it'll work. And there are probably loopholes as to whether or not that's legal. The other thing is, as we saw very clearly with the Virgil van Dijk saga in the summer, is that the punishments for tapping up are fairly harsh, and I'd say it's probably not in the Premier League's interests to implement them. So when you have Liverpool issuing an apology to Southampton and then returning for the same player about 4 weeks later, I think we can all probably agree they weren't very sorry, and they'd obviously just been told by the Premier League, if you apologise, we won't put the sanctions on you, which would end up probably damaging the competition, damaging the Premier League's reputation. So in that respect, it'll happen the whole time, and when it gets exposed or people complain, I think there has to be questions about the integrity of the sanctions that are meant to come in on clubs who do it.
Yeah. Have you got any insider info on the Bosman?
Well, I think it's, you know, people describe XG as the most useful stat. I think this is, tapping up's just it's a ridiculous issue because in any other form of business, it's just normal practice. And if you want to contact the player, you don't have to contact them directly. There's so many ways to do it. Football is a small world. If you don't know somebody, you know somebody who knows them.
Yeah.
And all it takes is one phone call. And of course, it's clubs use it to their advantage as well to unsettle players and set up players at rival clubs, so it puts them, maybe distracts them from their best form, and so. There's no way of stopping it. This is the thing, and unless people are caught red-handed, where they're actually in a meeting together, caught in a hotel, sort of.
That's a different one, isn't it? Caught in a hotel.
Hotel reception. Yeah, too often these trysts are made. You can't really stop it. So it's always happened. It always will. So I can't see the problem with it. It's just a part of football.
How many of these big names do we reckon are going for free then?
It's interesting. I think player power is so big now that probably a fair few of them.
Yeah.
I'm already bored of the Sanchez and Ozil storm before it's even started, because that'll be very, very tiresome. You'd think that Luke Shaw, despite his mini resurgence, I guess, yesterday, will probably be let go unless he can have an amazing turnaround. And Diafra Sakho, you'd have thought, will likely make way as well.
Diafra Sakho will go and bet on his horses again and somehow get a contract extension.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Barkley's an interesting one. Well, I mean, I'm not a huge fan, to be honest, but I think that...
Surely Allardyce is going to love Barkley, isn't he?
I'll just go over his head, won't he? But yeah. I think he probably will. But again, the way that Everton's recruitment's been set up, it means that they've now got Barkley, Rooney and Gilfy, who will all want to play basically that advanced midfield role centrally, or maybe just off the left. So... it looks like there could be some bargains around, really.
I think one thing this list does tell you, though, and it probably doesn't reflect great on the clubs of these players, simply because it's not great business practice for them. Yeah, I mean, unless they're happy for them to leave, they're still players under 24, you've still got some hold over the registration union, title of compensation of a fee, but, it should all be sorted by now. It shouldn't get to this point six months before the end of their contract that everything's still up in the air. And financially, it doesn't make sense because they're going to get less money from them than they would 6 months a year ago. So it's bemusing to me, really. Unless hope against hope that they're trying to keep those players at the club.
I think United retain a year option on all their ones. So Herrera, Mata, Shaw, Blint, and Fellaini, I think, all of them. Which is fairly decent, considering they're all, you know, Herrera was obviously player of the year last year, but he's become a fringe player this season. Mm. So, you know, Mata's the one you're really looking at there, and probably now Fellaini is the two that would be most likely kept on.
How much realistically can you demand of a player's transfer fee if they've only got 6 months left?
I think Arsenal are hoping quite a lot. Mm.
Yeah.
I still think Sanchez could go for about 30 million in January.
You think?
Yeah.
I think you could wait.
I think Pep's just like, you know, just get me in.
Doesn't matter.
Yeah, basically. So that'll be fun.
But that's it. I mean, in this situation, the selling clubs are just relying on the desperation of others.
Yeah.
So, you know, you might get a big club who's struggling near the bottom of the league and they're willing to pay more. So, and realistically, Arsenal are in a position where they can... It's very un-Arsenal-like way of doing business to not take advantage of it and get the 30, like you said, 30 million in.
Yeah.
But also clubs are so cash rich now that they can say, well, I'd rather have this player for 6 months and lose the rest of the fee.
I mean, Arsenal didn't even spend anything in the end, did they? They're going to have their £150 million war chest or whatever.
Lacazette was the only one
made a profit, didn't they?
Yeah.
Brilliant. All right, let's move on to the next section. Who's this fella?
Who's this fella?
All right, I'm going to make this very clear that I'm reading this name as I see it. So, who's this fella? Sergej Milinkovic-Savic?
Sergi, I think.
Okay, Sergi Milinkovic-Savic. Lazio goal scorer. How good is he, George? Because another thing I've got written on this paper is that I should be sending texts about him, because his name is SMS and it's the 25th anniversary of the SMS. Maybe a little tenuous, that one.
He's younger than the text message, that means. I think he's 23. Lazio are fun, generally. They are a fun team to watch this year. They've invested in young talent, and I think it's going to be interesting seeing how they progress. Obviously, they won 2-1 on the weekend with SMS. Can we just call him that, I think, because it's easier than doing the whole thing. With SMS getting the goal and the assist both in the last 10 minutes. He's kind of that modern-day footballer, I would say. Where
he's a big old boy as well,
isn't he? He's 6'3", 6'4". He is physical as well. You know, he's not one of those... I'm trying to think who's a good example. He gets stuck in. He's good in the air. He's good with his body, but he's also a very, very talented footballer. He is capable on the ball. He gets in the box late, makes it runs to the box to score goals. He's tidy in possession. He's a good player. I mean, the one thing I would say is he's fairly streaky. If you're looking at his record in Serie A this season, he's got 3 goals and 1 assist. And I think they've come in 3 games, all of them basically. So the rest of them, he's not really up to too much. But yeah. As a young talent, he looks very, very good, and I think that he's in a squad full of Lazio players where they're going to be encouraged to be fairly expressive. I'm trying to think of who I consider compare him to as a player, but there aren't really that many kind of giant...
Maybe Yaya Toure, a little bit like him.
But he plays a bit further forward, but maybe like a younger Yaya.
Maybe a bit like Ruben Loftus-Cheek. He's 6 foot four or something.
Yeah, Loftus-Cheek isn't a bad sell. I mean, I was going to say Nzonzi, but Nzonzi's a bit deeper. But no, he's that kind of, that very almost mercurial, tall, but robust midfielder.
I think if you're asking for an example of sort of what type of player he is, he'd be a great fit for Jose Mourinho and Man United side, especially at the moment.
The player that he wants Fellaini to be in.
Yeah, exactly. And he's got that physical capability. But when you've got the talent with your feet that he's got as well, he's so hard to get off the ball. You even see him in tight spaces.
Yeah.
You often see him with three players around him. And it keeps the ball close to him, but he just holds players off at will. And so that if he's got two players on him and try to take a ball from him, there's a free that means there's a free play somewhere else, and that's why it takes the advantage.
How much of an impact do you reckon the manager he has for the next sort of couple of years is going to have on how he ends up playing? Because if you get the wrong manager, he could end up being elbow merchant. Surely?
Well, I mean, yeah, I guess so. But I think that's the case with any player, isn't it? I think especially we've seen in the Premier League, having Mr. Mourinho and Mr. Guardiola here, how you stand Luke Shaw and Raheem Sterling side by side 2 years ago, there probably isn't much difference in terms of their ceiling. And now one is probably looking at a move to a kind of...
Probably unfair with Luke Shaw's leg break, though, isn't it?
Yeah, okay. I think that's fair enough. But even so, we've seen it with Mourinho a fair few times, the way he can... And I think the way he's dealt with Marcus Rashford's been really good. After I was initially very critical that he was stuck him out wide, but I think Rashford's improved as a player because of it. Although I still think that if Rashford was Guardiola's, it would have been a very different process. So, as with any young talent who's kind of hitting the scene in Europe, it's going to be important that he's encouraged to develop into the player that he should be.
I think Serie A isn't a bad place to be at the moment if you're an attacker, though. It's
a good place to be for anyone. It's a great league.
Given that the sort of stereotype of it has always been sort of defensive and cagey and dirty, last year it was the highest scoring league, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I think it's going to be again this year.
Yeah, and you've got teams, you know, Napoli, I think people wax lyrical about them, like what a great attacking team they are. And Lazio this year, and Inter Milan are scoring. So yeah, it seems like he'll...
Yeah, I agree. And as I said, I think Lazio especially are a really exciting prospect.
Is it Ciro Immobile?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how much longer he'll be there, but he's had a few moves that haven't worked out for him. Away from Italy, and which have failed. I think he didn't at Sevilla and at Dortmund. So he's probably the kind of player who, now he's back to scoring goals, but won't be in a hurry to move on. And he's class as well.
Mm. All right, then let's go on to the final section, the stat showdown.
Stat showdown.
Okay, then here we are, the stats showdown. George, of course, is a veteran of the showdown. He often comes with the wacky stats that, you know, really please me, like to my very core. David Priest, you're a newbie to the stat showdown.
I am, yeah.
It's a best two out of three impress me game, basically, of stats knowledge, pretty much. So kind of snappy, usable stats that don't take 16 minutes to describe to people. Pub ammo, let's call it. So, George, we'll let you lead the way with the first stat.
I'm going very continental for all my stats this week. In Serie A this weekend, Chievo play Roma. Roma striker Edin Dzeko has had more shots in the opposition's six-yard box this season in Serie A than the whole Chievo team put together. 8 plays 7.
How many has he scored? Because I saw him missing that.
I don't know. Oh. A fair few, I'd have thought.
No, see, yeah, no, he missed Dzeko before their goal on Tuesday night, didn't he? Yeah. And then the Gazer followed it up.
Yeah.
Edin Dzeko. He's done really well out there, hasn't he?
It's class. Well, he's a brilliant player, basically.
Actually, he did pretty well at Man City. Yeah, he just wasn't Sergio Aguero.
In and out of the team the whole time as well. So.
Yeah. Okay.
Celtic could make it 67 games unbeaten in the Scottish Premier League on Saturday or this weekend. But that's nothing compared to Steaua Bucharest, who went 104 games unbeaten. That's the world record home
104
unbeaten
games.
Run. 104 games. That was I think it was 1986 to 1989, just after they won the year.
But the Romanian league was terrible then.
I heard that was the height of the...
I'm joking. I have no idea.
It was the height of the Romanian league. Okay. I'm going first point to the debutant.
Yeah, I think that's right.
David Preece.
I agree, fair enough.
Preece's pieces.
Thank you.
Comes in. So, David, now you follow up.
So then. we spoke about Brignoli's goal at the weekend for Benevento.
Yeah.
Scoring his first goal in first team football, first class football. But he's got a long way to go before he reaches the heights of Ruggiero Ceni.
Ah, yes.
131 goals.
We've already spoken about set piece merchants in this, so I think we can. just Gylfi Sigurdsson playing in goal, isn't he? Right, what do I use here? You've obviously been impressed by streaks. I'm going off to Liga Nosh. Estoril, who obviously made great by Marco Silva all those years ago, are currently on a run where they haven't scored in 8 matches, consecutive games, 720 minutes of football. This weekend, they're out going to Benfica, who have kept 3 clean sheets in a row. I think we can probably expect that to be extended for another one.
Benfica, very much bottom of their Champions League group.
Imagine being a fan.
And not seeing a goal for 9...
8 games. Well,
8 games.
Soon to be 9, yeah.
Okay. George, you can have that one.
Thanks, mate.
We've done the set-piece merchants. We'll tie it up. 1 apiece. Now, you follow up and try and get the killer blow in. The killer stat.
Barcelona are playing Villarreal this weekend, who have scored more goals from open play than Real Madrid this season.
Villarreal?
Yeah, 17. Real Madrid only scored 15 goals from open play in La Liga this season.
God.
Yeah.
That's rubbish.
Set piece merchants.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I can't believe that.
Good. That's the whole point.
Yeah. All right. Setting a high standard, David. I think you're punching up here.
I'll stick with goalkeepers here. If Simon Mignolet keeps a clean sheet, which will be his 5th and 9 against Everton, he will have the same clean sheets per Merseyside derby record as Liverpool legend Ria Clements, 15-27.
Simon Mignolet, meant to be naff, but clearly not. Or not in Merseyside derbies anyway. Oh, both surprised me. But I think I was physically taken aback by how poor Real Madrid have been. So I'm going to go final point to George. I'm sorry, David.
Come back, win.
To be fair, I was very impressed with his Portuguese pronunciation as well.
Yeah.
Estoril, Liga Nosh.
Well, yeah, when you said Liga Nosh, I had no idea what you were talking about. I've been calling it Liga Nosh. Yeah, I know that one. Portuguese league, innit? George, where can people find you on the internet if they want to hear more Portuguese pronunciations of things?
If they want to hear that, then they should probably just come and chat to me. But otherwise, yeah, on Twitter, at George Elek, E-L-E-K is my surname.
And David, yourself?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter, it's at DavidPriest12, where I normally just bang on about goalkeeping.
I'm plugging podcasts.
Yeah.
And you can find me at Rob_WH. You can find this podcast on Deezer or iTunes or all the places you find your podcast. Subscribe, share, review, all the good stuff. And of course, don't forget that you can listen to the Merseyside Derby this weekend on the Deezer app. And we will see you next time on Defending in Numbers.
Defending in Numbers is a Deezer Originals production. You can find and download more episodes on Deezer and all major podcast providers.